This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Hello, everyone. First, my name is Aziz. I'm using a presentation I did just recently, and so a couple of the pictures might not be relevant, but I'll make the jokes I intended originally about them. And I don't like podiums. They're annoying because they make you separate from people. And you're not going to see what I'm talking about, so you're not going to laugh at the jokes. Anyway, I do many things. I've never held a full-time job for the last, I think, 15 years, more or less. And I do many things because my interest goes into very different directions. So I'm on one hand an entrepreneur, that's how I do tourism. On another hand, I'm an educator, I've done a lot of work in a university. On another hand, I'm a tourism person. On another hand, I'm an explorer, where I work at National Geographic as an explorer and cultural educator. And I put this picture on because, well, this me looking like an explorer, which I think is cool. But when I was called, just around the time I met Daniel, I was called by National Geographic and they said, well, we chose you as an explorer, which is something you can't apply for. They choose you and it feels kind of very cool, prestigious, except I didn't know much about what that meant. And I started trying to understand. Then I called all my friends. I'm like, yeah, I'm an explorer in National Geographic. This is kind of cool, you know, and my friends kept laughing at me, saying, why would they choose you as an explorer? What do you explore? Exploration is about archaeology, it's about space, it's about conservation. And my answer used to be, I explore the faculty lounge. Because there are some antiquities of the sandwich in the back of that faculty lounge. So it worked very well. I want to start by telling you a little bit about myself, and then we can... And then we can get into some of the work I'm doing. And what I'll do, I'll tell you more than just my tourism work. I'll go into details of maybe other projects I'm doing and make the focus more on the tourism company. I grew up just out of here, Jerusalem, a couple miles east in a place called Bethany, Izaria. When I grew up there, I was born in 1980. When I grew up there, it was not as developed as it is now. It was a very small town. My dad was one of the first people who bought a land there and built his house before 67, and then after 67 it was assumed to be part of Jerusalem, but eventually we figured out the municipality decided, or the government, that it's not part of Jerusalem. And I grew up to a conservative Muslim family. I'm the youngest of seven, which what you call the oops child. My family did not plan on having me. I'm 9 years younger than the one who's just older than me, which was fun also because you get to get away with the stuff your older siblings can't get away with. I was introduced to the conflict very early because in 1987 was the first Intifada. And by the way, this is me when I was 7 years old, 6 years old. This is as the Intifada started. That's my older brother, Taysir. I like to say normally, this is me when I used to look good. And as I got older, I just met a neighbor that I haven't seen for maybe 25 years from Bethany. And she said, oh, Aziz, you used to look so cute. That was the most depressing thing. But it's true, though. I did used to look cute. When I was seven, the Intifada started, and I remember watching on TV people throwing rocks and getting to the closest road of my home and thinking, well, they throwing rocks, it seems fun, there's no playground, there's no community center, there's nothing to do in my neighborhood. And so getting to the closest road, picking up some stones, starting throwing, not realizing we were apparently supposed to throw stones at Israeli cars, I ended up throwing rocks for some at my neighbor's cars. They did not think it was cute at all. And when they visited my parents, I got disciplined. But growing up in that situation does affect you significantly. So I'll give you an example. Anybody grew up here or most of you in the States? I'm going to give you a very interesting information. When I went to school, I had to take with me, like everybody, what did you take with you when you were 7 years old? What was the most important thing?
Lunchbox.
What else? Pencils. Anything else?
A knife.
A knife? Why would you take a knife? I didn't take a knife. All right. I won't pressure you on that. Yeah. I took with me an onion. Anybody knows why I took with me an onion? My mom made sure every morning I had an onion with me. Anybody can guess why?
In case you met a vampire.
I didn't know about that, but that's awesome. In your experience, it's about vampires. I like this group. Well, it's because Palestinians believe that if you fire that tear gas, if you have an onion with you, you cut the onion, you put it close to your nose, and that would actually help you overcome the tear gas effect on you. I'm not sure how much it's real, but we definitely believed it. And so every morning, my mom, instead of being worried about my homework or my lunchbox or my pencils, first thing she would make sure is that my onion is fresh. And living in that way, I actually believed growing up that everybody around the world probably had the same experience, that all of you in the States or wherever you come from probably grew up with an onion going to school. And it took me years later realizing that that's not the norm. That's not how you grow up. And going to school, we did face that quite a lot, being fired at, tear gas, being shot at, and so on. So growing up in that reality eventually shapes who you are, but you still don't really understand it until it hits home, I think. And it did hit home for me when I was 9 years old, when my brother Taysir here, he's 9 years older than me, was 18 at the time. He was arrested on suspicion of throwing rocks. He was arrested from home. About 5 in the morning was an early morning of Ramadan. We get up, you know, before sunrise to eat and drink so you're not dehydrated through the day since you're fasting all day long. And a few minutes after I went back to bed, the army came into our house, broke in, came in, questioned all my brothers. I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters who are older than me, and decided to arrest Taysir. We didn't know what was happening with him for a while. Eventually, we realized he was arrested because of suspicion of throwing rocks. He refused to confess, which meant he was beaten up until he did. He was sentenced for 1 year in prison, and a little less than a year later, he was released because his health has got very bad. Through the interrogation, the beating affected his liver, had a liver failure, had a spleen failure, had the internal injuries. By the time he was let out of prison, he was quite ill. We took him to a hospital in East Jerusalem in the Mount of Olives. And a few days after his surgery, he passed away in the hospital. Taysir was 19 years old when that happened. I was 10 years old. And I want you to try to imagine being 10 years old and seeing your brother being arrested and then seeing him die just about a year later. It's not natural cause. It's not a normal thing. He was healthy and suddenly he's dead. I went to visit Taysir only once when he was in prison, and it was a very hard visit because it takes a whole day. You go, you wait in line for hours, and then you get 2 fences, and you're standing on one side, he's standing on the other, and there are tons of people also visiting, and you're all yelling at each other, and you barely can hear each other, and you have 10 minutes to communicate. And those are the main images that stuck in my memory from these days. When Taysir died, I was very angry. I was very bitter. And I felt that the only thing that you should or can or have to do, it's your duty to do, is to revenge. Because if you don't revenge for your brother, then you are a bad brother. Then you are a bad person. If somebody kills your brother, you can't just do nothing about it. It almost feels like if I just walk to you right now and I just punch you in the face, what's the first thing you're going to do?
Ask her to punch you back.
Ask. All right. Most people, though, are not that holy. Most people will punch you back themselves. I should have asked you, by the way. Most people will punch you back. How many people do you know that if somebody punched them in the face, they go, let me take a step backward and think about this logically. What should I do? What is the right thing to do? How many people do that? I think, very few. And I was not one of these people. I was very angry. I was very bitter. And to me, it meant finding ways to revenge. And that's what I did for the next 8 years. I soon after joined a political party called Fatah. Became very active. Became one of their youth leaders in Jerusalem. And my job was writing. Similar to whatever you read today, very angry, very us versus them, it's our right, we are always right, they always wrong. And I edited that youth magazine for a few years, and then I was working on mobilizing, getting more people active, going out to protests, all these things. Did that until I was 18 years old. And This is Taysir soon before he passed away. When I was 18 years old, I realized that I have a problem. Because in my high school, it was mandatory to learn Hebrew. But I've managed to go through 3 years not learning not even one word. Because I thought it's the language of the enemy and you should not learn the language of the enemy. Which was not a smart thing to do. Because apparently in Jerusalem, if you don't speak Hebrew, you're not going to be able to go to college, really. You're not going to be able to find a job. You're not going to be able to get your life going. And so I started looking for a good place to learn Hebrew. Anybody guesses where is a good place to learn Hebrew? Ulpan. So I signed up for Ulpan, and I went to an Ulpan called Ulpan Mila. It's on King George Street. I was the only Palestinian in that classroom. And it was quite an awkward thing because up until this moment, I was 18 years old, I have never met an Israeli, a Jewish person who was not a soldier or a settler in a normal conversation. I mean, obviously, I've seen them passing and stuff and maybe had a quick talk, but never had a real conversation with somebody who was just a person who's not carrying a gun and telling me whether I can pass or not. Just 3 years earlier, my family were told we cannot live in our house in Jerusalem, in Bethany anymore, because it's outside the Jerusalem municipality. And if we do, we cannot keep our Jerusalem ID. We would have to move to the West Bank and never have access to Jerusalem. And for a few months, when my school was in Jerusalem, until we were able to rent an apartment in Jerusalem, I would have to go around these soldiers. And if they see you, they'll either shoot at you or catch you or beat you up. Whichever. And that was the only image I really had of Israelis, is me trying to sneak to school and them trying to arrest me because I didn't have the papers to do that because we lived in Bethany. And suddenly I'm sitting in this classroom, and just like here, I was the only Palestinian in that program, and I figured it out. I'm going to sit here, learn the language, but I'm not going to talk to anybody. I thought I was really smart enough to learn the language without ever speaking it. And apparently it was not true. So I started talking to people because the teachers would force us to. And it would have us say things like, hi, how are you? In Hebrew, shalom, ma shalomcha, ma kore, איך אתה מרגיש? כל מיני דברים כאלה, all these kind of things. And slowly you get to know people. And it was an amazing experience because suddenly these people who I didn't like, I realized I had some kind of commonality with them. Not on politics, because we didn't know enough Hebrew to talk politics, but more on cool things, like what kind of music you listen to. My favorite music is an American kind of music. It's called country music. Western country music. I'm talking Johnny Cash and Brad Paisley and Miranda Lambert, and not her husband, because he's not a cool guy. But these are my favorite singers. And let me tell you, Palestinians have no idea what country music is. So it was a boring thing trying to explain to a Palestinian what kind of music I listen to. And suddenly, not that many Jews also really like country music, but suddenly in that class I found a couple of people who did. And so we would sit and talk about it. And then we'll go out and drink coffee together and then argue about which coffee is better, Israeli coffee or Arabic coffee. And most of them, for some reason, like instant coffee, Nescafe, which is horrible. And I would try to convince them that Arabic coffee was the better coffee. But that experience was an amazing experience for me because suddenly these walls that separated us were starting to fall apart. That for 18 years, I had no interaction whatsoever with these people is changing. And I'm not having an interaction just as I have to meet you for a purpose. It became something more. And this was just as Bibi Netanyahu was then the prime minister, and there was all kind of violence going on, and then Barack became prime minister after, and there was all kind of suicide bombing. And one of the things that's changed for me is the next time I heard something happening in West Jerusalem or somebody getting hurt or somebody a suicide bombing, it became very different, because for the first time it became about the people I know. So the first thought that would go through my mind was, oh, my friend lives in that neighborhood. I need to call them and make sure they are okay. And the next time somebody got arrested or somebody got shot in East Jerusalem, they were the ones calling me, making sure that I was fine, because I was the only Palestinian also they have met. And being able to start putting cracks in that wall of who we are and who they are, I realized how segregated we are, not just by physical walls, which also is a problem, but I lived at that point in East Jerusalem. In 10 minutes walk, I could have been in West Jerusalem. 5 minutes from my high school, there was a Jewish school. We've never met, never talked. We threw sometimes rocks at each other. That was our only interaction. And that kind of separation makes you start making up stories about the other side. You start dehumanizing them. You start demonizing them. And I'm sure they did it to me as much as I did it to them. And you start also believing you are more moral and more ethical than those on the other side. And, you know, and you'll find always a good reason, and I hear it now from both the Palestinians and Israelis, and you'll find a good reason to say they are a little bit less ethical, and therefore they're a little bit even less human, because look what they do. How could a human being do the stuff they're doing? And the moment you get to that point, you don't have to feel bad or guilty about anything happening on the other side. This experience ended up changing my life significantly. And everything I've done since then is connected to that classroom, to that experience. I'm very grateful because I had an amazing teacher in that class. And if it wasn't for her, I think none of this would have happened. She went out of her way to make me feel comfortable, to recognize my narrative, to recognize my story. She would ask me to bring Arabic songs to class, and then we translate them together to Hebrew and then get the class to listen to it, which I thought, this is weird. She cares about what I think and where I'm coming from and my kind of music. She didn't let me bring country music, though. That was a big no, apparently. But it helped me step out of my comfort zone. And what I want to talk about is everything I've done since then is helping myself and those I work with and the target audience I'm working with is to step out of their comfort zone and going to a place that is uncomfortable but is an amazing place. And I did that through three different ways. I'll go through them quickly and get to... I'm going to check how I'm on time. Still... Learning about the other. One of the first things I ended up doing is realizing how little about history I knew when it comes to the Israeli narrative. And so in 99, I decided, before I knew any Palestinian who's done this, go to Yad Vashem and learn about the Holocaust, which was very hard to do because most Palestinians don't know anything about the Holocaust. We never learned about it in school. We never understand anything about it. Even when people tell you they deny it, it's coming out of, I just never learned about it. And the idea is you cannot sympathize with your enemy. If you learn about your enemy, you might feel for them, and then that's what will weaken your morale. And I remember going to Yad Vashem and in the beginning feeling like that, feeling I'm here to learn about what they think, not so much about what happened. Just because I now work with them, we have to know what they think. And as I went through, it was an amazing changing experience, because you start identifying with the people who you're seeing through the pictures and through the stories, and you start feeling the pain, you start sympathizing, and you start understanding, and that changes the way you look at the other and start understanding how people think. And a couple of my friends at that time were one, Rami Elchanan, whose father was in Auschwitz, and the other is Yaakov Guterman, who's a Holocaust survivor from Poland. And I watched my relationship with these two people change significantly, because for the first time, I was able to understand where they're coming from and understand their pain. But also, one of the things that ended up happening, well, that actually will fit. This is Rami, by the way. Rami Al-Hana. Oh, I'm flying through. I'm going to be... Here we go. This is Rami Al-Hanan. The second thing that ended up happening is watching stereotypes being changing. So I wrote an article right after for Haaretz, which I showed you excerpt from soon after. And I decided I'm not going to write about the Palestinian suffering in that article. I'm going to only write about what I learned from my visit to the Holocaust Memorial. I got a phone call a couple of days later from the editor who said, this was a very interesting article. It was weird because normally we get a lot of people angry at anything deals with Israel-Palestine. You know, tons of bad comments online. And this one didn't get all these bad comments. Most of the comments were positive. But the second thing that ended up happening is that I started getting emails of people saying, I just read your article in Haaretz, and I was moved that you went the extra mile to hear about my narrative. What do you suggest I do to learn about yours? I thought, that's interesting, because I spend my life, and I think in many ways many of us do, trying to push our own stories on the other side. And only when I did the exact opposite of listening to the other, that they listened to me, that they finally wanting to hear my story, is when I didn't push my story and said, I just want to sympathize with you, I want to understand you, I want to connect with you, that they were able to open up and say, how can I learn more about you? And that's changing stereotypes. Rami's daughter was killed by a Palestinian suicide bomber. She was 14 years old, Smadar, in Kikar Tzion. He's one of the closest people I have. He's helped me significantly in my life and as a friend, and whenever I get in trouble. I traveled with him to Egypt, and I ended up by mistake in Egypt, by mistake, because I'm Palestinian, ended up in Egyptian jail while he's the Israeli didn't. And it was Rami, I mean, talk about irony, it was Rami who helps me get out of an Arab jail. Changing stereotypes again. Arabs love Palestinians and they hate Israelis. He comes in, I get in prison, he walks and gets me out of prison by making some phone calls. Changing stereotypes completely. But Rami and I would go, like many other people in the Bereaved Families Forum, an organization I ended up joining and working as chairman in it, going to schools and talking to people and telling our own narratives together, not as enemies, not as competition about who has more pain, but together bringing our stories and watching people for the first time either hearing a Palestinian or hearing an Israeli and how that affected who they are. In the beginning, it's normally they're angry, they're mad at you, they never met somebody from the other side, so they have all these opinions and thoughts about how horrible you are and you just want to kill us. When Rami goes into a Palestinian school, all the students will be like, you soldiers and you this and you that. And an hour and a half later, watching them for the first time having a real conversation. It's not necessarily changing everything, but the only interaction that they've ever had. I did something. I'm apparently technologically challenged. Okay. Yes. Experiential education is what... how we met. Oh, wow. That was a big jump. I think I'm too far. There we go. Okay, experiential education. I want to talk briefly about this, and then we'll go into tourism, so I'm not over killing the time. Apparently, I talk more than I thought I do. Sorry. When I started working at George Mason, one of the things we realized, I was doing conflict in a conflict resolution program, and one of the things we realized is a lot of our students studying conflict resolution but had zero experience in going into conflict zones. And then you finish a master's or a PhD or whatever degree you want in conflict resolution, then you go and start working, realizing maybe this is not the thing I wanted to do originally because it is not easy. And so we start taking groups of students, some to here and some to other places. One of these, you know, our first class was here with Daniel and with Pardes, and the idea of an
room
Arab
C.
and a Jew in what?
It was in room C.
I don't remember that
downstairs.
Much. Yeah, probably. That was 6 years ago. You know, in Jerusalem, which is what we ended up doing also in the company, having a Palestinian and was me, you, and Mark, and two Jewish rabbis leading a group of students together and bringing different opinions and different narratives to the students, something that they haven't seen. But we decided to also go into other places, and one of those other places was Syria. And before the revolution in Syria, we used to go take classes to there. But as the revolution happened, we decided maybe we'll go to Turkey. And so 2012, 2013, we started taking groups to Turkey. And these are pictures I took from Turkey and Jordan for classes we've done there. And it changed a lot of how I saw conflict and conflict resolution for me personally, and understanding the other and understanding multiple sides. Because actually our classes used to go in coordination with Assad when we were in Syria. And as the revolution happened, we learned about the other narrative much, much more, the narrative of the people who were massacred by Assad. Learning about 10 million people that have been displaced, learning about that half of them are children, learning that most of them don't go to school anymore. And I realized that what I was learning in the media was, well, these Syrians are a threat to our security. But in reality, they're being a threat because you have 5 million kids who don't go to school anymore. We can learn about them later when they become a security threat, or we can try to engage with them before that happens. And unfortunately, very little was being done to do that. Going to refugee camps where Syrian kids in a refugee camp, anybody in a refugee camp, you're not actually allowed to leave the camp. This is in Za'atari refugee camp in Jordan. And this kid carrying a piece of a crushed Coke or Pepsi bottle. This is where he lived. He doesn't remember his life before the refugee camp. He's arrived there about a couple years earlier. His name is Ahmad. He's probably 6 years old, 5 or 6 years old. And I saw him walking from here all the way to here, and he was very upset when he was walking. Za'atari is not a fun place to be at. But one of the things that was interesting, as he walked, he saw this piece of metal underground. And suddenly he started smiling. And he started smiling because he finally has a toy. This is as happy as I've seen this kid, watching him for about half an hour. This is the only smile he had, is because he was able to get a crushed can and play with it. Now, why I'm mentioning that? That experiential education, it changed my understanding. And I realized that going and learning was not enough, that we have to do something more. So my colleague who's Syrian, Nusha, and I decided we're not going back to the States after the class. We're going to stay. And then doing stupid thing is going to the Syrian border and trying to cross, which we eventually did. Don't advise you to do that, by the way. Not everything I say is a good example. And we crossed in, and it was very devastating watching millions of people living in tents inside Syria that we never hear about, that still don't want to leave despite all the bombings and despite all the problems that's going on there. And starting to figure out what can we do. And one of the things we started doing was setting up educational camps, working on convincing friends of ours to help start schools for these kids, trying to bring them materials to study. And it was still a very helpless feeling because you cannot really push for a policy change. We weren't able to make a major change. And often I think many of us decide not to engage because we think in the big picture, I might not be able to make a difference. And what we realize there, that even if you can't make a difference in the big picture, you still can make a difference to somebody. But I still wanted to do a little more than that. And so I ended up convincing National Geographic to send with me a few photographers and go and meet with some of these kids and teaching them. Yeah, I'm going to need you. And teaching them, oops, go back a little bit. Teaching them about photography and giving them some cameras and just the technical aspects. And the reason I did that, I realized that I was telling these kids the stories over and over all over the world, and I don't think it was a real story. I was telling my perspective, and I wanted them to tell their own perspective. And that's why we gave them cameras. And I assumed if you give a kid in a refugee camp a camera, what will they take a picture of? The tent, how miserable their lives are, the family members that were killed, talk about that, how poor they are, because they lived as horrible as you can imagine. And instead, we got, you want to go through them again? You got, this is a guy who's never had a camera, never took a picture, and this was his first day shot. Want to go through them playing soccer. You saw earlier two kids holding hands with each other, their family, their friends. And then they started, that we asked them to write a story with it. And this is one of these stories. Let me see if I can read it here. Can you go to the next one? Yeah. It says, to whom it may concern, this word I read on my UNHCR asylum seeker certificate. I'm a Syrian child. The only thing I hope in this world is to wake up from this terrible nightmare and to return to my friends, to return to my life, to return to home before this war. And if time goes back, I just want to play with the people who lost their lives. And I will ask them to leave Syria. I never thought that I would live in a tent, but that's all right. I never thought that I will not listen to my English teacher, who I love her so much in Syria, but that's all right. I never thought that I will not breathe the smells of Syrian fields in summer nights, but that's all right. But to whom it may concern, please stop war and let me go back to my past life. I realized what's really needed is people to tell their own stories, not me telling their story. Today, we're doing camps every 3 months, educational camps with 1,000 kids coming to those camps. All the people in it are volunteers. Where? Jordan, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, a community center in Aleppo. It's run through volunteers from all over the world coming to it. Not one foundation has ever supported this project. Not one government has ever supported it. And fair enough, we've never really pushed hard because we wanted us to do it. So every one of us volunteers going helps out and ask their friends and their family and their relatives and whoever and get the money and we go and we rent a place and we buy some food and we buy some materials and bring the kids and pay for transportation. And I think it was able to do much more because we did that and had no control of anybody, much more than we would have expected. And then slowly some of these volunteers coming in started asking, how can we do more? And there are some kids who are not going to school, so started looking at renting places and getting schools started. Fully run by volunteers, one of them in Jarosh, Jordan, 44 students last year who were not accepted in schools because their level was so bad, they haven't been to school in 3 years. A year later, 41 of them went back to school because we were able to bring them back into a level that were accepted into local Jordanian schools. And the big scheme of things, it wasn't much, but on these 41 students' life, it's everything. Now, doing all of this, I've always had one frustration, which is sustainability. Because when you don't have a way to keep running the project, it eventually dies. And even with this, if the money dries, you can't do it anymore. If things change, you can't do it anymore. So I was looking at how can we do this in a more sustainable way. And that's where tourism came in. Because often when people think about tourism, you can go another one. When often people think about tourism, they think about, well, I'll go, I'll see the holy site, and I go back home. Or I go and spend time on the beach, and I go back home. And that's not accurate. That's not how most or many people at least want to travel. And I was meeting so many travelers coming to here and being frustrated with their inability to engage or with one-sided tours. It's either or on the Jewish side or all on the Palestinian side, and they might bring a one or two token Palestinians or token Jews so they can make it sound a little okay. And we didn't, something just didn't feel right. over 1 billion, now it's 1.2 billion people travel internationally every year. That's the biggest exchange you can even imagine, the biggest cultural exchange you can imagine. And yet most of these people travel with not a one interaction with somebody, with one authentic real experience. You can go to another country and not meet anybody. You sit in your bus and you have your Zoom camera and you're taking the pictures of people from so far where you don't have to engage with them because you can have now 400, 500 Zoom and so it'll be fine. You don't need to really, you're sitting in your air-conditioned bus and just snapping pictures. And I remember as a kid going through that, being in Jerusalem and tourists coming by and they come down and they click this picture and then they walk away without even saying hello. And I remember it being very frustrating. Actually, Yehuda Amichai, who's probably the best, I think, Israeli poet, wrote a poem about that called Tourist. And in it, he exactly targets the same thing. He started with Yad Vashem, and he's saying they're coming and cry on our memorials, and then they lust after our women, and then they go to Jaffa Gate, and their guide, there's a guy, I'm paraphrasing, he's much better poet than this, but he's talking about this man with baskets of fruits and vegetables sitting at Jaffa Gate, and the guide goes, see that man there? Go a little bit above, a little bit to the left, that's a Roman arch. He said, redemption will come when that same tour guide will point to the Roman arch. He said, see that Roman arch up there? A little bit to the right, a little down, sits a man who bought fruits and vegetables for his family. It's redefining how travel is. And that's what we wanted to do. And that's why we started this company called Mejdi. Mejdi is owned by, it's a Jewish-Palestinian partnership, which does not happen much. It's a 50-50 Jewish-Palestinian partnership, which also, when there are partnerships, it's rare that they are 50-50. Our staff are a mix, Christian, Muslims, and Jews. We bring tour guides together, so every trip, instead of having one tour guide, can you go to the next one, and I'll go back to this one after. This is Hussam Jubran, this is Yuval Ben Ami. One is Palestinian, one is Israeli. Do you know them?
Yes, for our track, they did a track. Yeah.
Did you like them?
Yes.
Okay. But having, this doesn't normally happen, is having two tour guides traveling together through the whole time, telling people different perspectives. Not that they represent the Israeli, all Israelis, or the Palestinian, or Palestinians, but it creates a dialogue. It creates a conversation, and they're able to bring the different opinions in their own community. And able to change how people perceive this place, that it's not only one-sided thing. And our goal is not that we will paint a nicer picture, there are problems and they will talk about it, but to show an alternative way of looking at things, to show the different opinions, and maybe to have some hope when they leave, because the fact that there's an Israeli and a Palestinian working together is a hopeful thing, especially in these days. The fact that they're getting paid exactly the same is a hopeful thing. The fact that they see themselves not just as co-workers now, but as friends. I've worked, as I said, a lot in NGOs, and a lot of the meetings I've done, some at least, where you bring Israelis and Palestinians having a meeting, then each goes to his home, didn't always work that well. Because each one goes to his own reality, they meet for an hour or two, and then you have to live differently. But here, that's different, because they live together, work together, get paid exactly the same, and it builds a different kind of dynamic where they are on the same level. They can see eye to eye. They both speak about different views. Going back to the other one before it. But also, not only speaking with the tour guide, but have access to people. This is my mom, and that's the best meal you could ever have. It's not kosher if you use the Laban, the yogurt. It's called Ma'lube, by the way. And having them go, have meals with Palestinian families. After this meal, we had a joint band, Arab-Jewish musicians, playing music together and get up and dance. And it's normally one of the highlights. Going to a Shabbat dinner in Jerusalem, going meeting with, we just had a group, met with a spokesman for the Yesha Council for settlers, and then met with a Palestinian politician, then met with a spokesperson from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then met with a Druze family, and then met with an archaeologist, and then went to Ir David, and then went after that to Silwan. And having the multiple views of people who might be a bit more radical, people more moderate, maybe people a bit too left, and just having that overall view is able to make you see the place different. And what we did not only here in Israel and Palestine, we decided to do it in other places as well, because we saw it was working in Israel and Palestine. And so we went to Northern Ireland, where we had Catholic and Protestant, loyalists and nationalists, and went to Turkey, started exploring narratives of the Kurds and of the Greek-Turkish conflict. You can't always have the two tour guides together everywhere, so we had to adjust to it, but have that access to people, where we go to Turkey and then volunteer with Syrian refugees, and then going to Egypt and doing a Christian and Muslim tour guides together. Again, it doesn't have to be even just about opposites, but different, multiple cultures, multicultural experience, an authentic experience that you wouldn't have if you travel in other way. And it's been a fascinating thing because, one, it's sustainable. Since we started, the company continues to grow every year. Today, we have groups from here in the country, from Michigan, University of Michigan, Notre Dame, Northeastern, and St. Norbert. Four universities, and I take a lot of pride of that because it's reaching more and more and more people who saying, we don't want to travel to be part of a propaganda. We don't want to travel to say, well, the Jews are right, the Arabs are wrong, or the Arabs are right and the Jews are wrong, but we want to really have a much bigger exposure. And it's not that they won't leave being more pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. Sometimes they do. People will always have a little bit of bias here and there. But at least for the first time, they had a real exposure. And to us, that matters a lot. To me, that matters a lot that we do something like this. Ibn Battuta, who's an Arab traveler from about 700-800 years ago, said, travel makes you speechless. But then it turns you into a storyteller. And in my whole work with conflict resolution and peace building, I can tell you this, statistics and numbers and all of that are important, but nothing changes people like stories. And when things seem impossible, it's stories that move people's hearts. It's stories that makes you humanize the person you see, the enemy. It's stories that make you care. And if we're able to make people leave with a story and do it in a sustainable way where it can fund itself, you don't have to beg for money every year from different foundations who tell you what to do or different governments who tell you how to do it. It's a business. The only people you have to please are your customers and your staff. And that is a totally different aspect. And I think if we want to see change here, the approach of business as part of joint ventures is very important in our strategy. I talked a lot, and we should have about 10-15 minutes for questions. I have like tons of stuff I wanted to say, but tomorrow. Well. Yes. I think it's probably true for Hamas. For Fatah, it wasn't. We were given an option. Do you want to, after you finish high school, do you want to join the Palestinian Authority and become more active or not? And I decided at that point, I was very frustrated already, still frustrated with it. It's still, unfortunately, you have to be over certain age to become anything important. I realized my chance of making a change by working with politics in Palestine was very small. I'd have to become 70, 80 years old for that to happen. And I just didn't. It was by choice. Yes, it was by choice. It also, being angry all the time leaves you empty. And I at some point started realizing that. Yes. What's your name?
Fustin.
Yes, absolutely. I think learning the language is very important because language is not only words, it's communication. What you're learning is how to communicate. And we can say the same word, but can mean different things. And when you learn the language, you learn the meaning behind the words. I think it was very important. So I think you all should learn some Arabic, it would make a big difference. And people see you differently too when you speak, I think, their language, when you're able to communicate with them in their language. There is a strong bond that happens. I do a lot of work with National Geographic Cengage learning. It's English as a second language, and I do a lot of talks about how language is very important in bridging the gap between the groups and understanding cultures and understanding where people come from in every aspect. Now, the only thing trouble with that is often when you have two groups in one place, normally the weaker learn the language of the stronger. So you'll find more Palestinians in Israel, more Arabs in Israel learning Hebrew because they have to, while as an Israeli you don't really have to because the Arab community will just have to do it if they want to be able to live here. Yes?
Hi, my name is Dan. I heard throughout how you would take a step back and leave space for people to contribute or ask their own questions or come to you, whether it was the sending you the emails after the article or the kids contributing their photos and the acceleration of these movements. With the tour guiding, is that also
mostly, so far, it's still word of mouth, but we do have travel planners who help us reach out to more people and help build the itineraries because we work with each group to see their needs. If they are a program students, we have a group coming from Arizona, students studying journalism, I will focus more on journalism. So I have them learn about Israelis and Palestinians who are doing journalism work together, left-wing, right-wing, media outlets and so on. If they are into religion, then I focus more on that. But our travel planners do that. But many of our customers have come through word of mouth and just learned about us from people who are happy of their experience. And I think equality, one of the things good about having a business, you do have to have equality, customer service, all of that. We have to operate like a real company because otherwise we don't want people to come just because we have a nice concept. We want people to come because we are the best in what we provide. We are providing the best content. We are providing the best customer service. We are providing the best experience. So we want people to leave feeling that all of this was good, not just, oh, well, they have good content and that's it. So that's an important part of it, where if you are, and I'm not trying to say it about anybody, but I think when you are only an NGO, sometimes some of those aspects might not be as important because your customer, if they're not paying you directly, you don't have to be the best customer service because there's no direct... I sound like a capitalist, a true capitalist right now. But it is really true, and I saw it in how the perception of people who worked with us in nonprofit and worked with us in work with me in business is very different. Wow. Okay. I'll keep going back and forth. Hi. Yes.
I'm Rabbi Rosalind Glazer. I live here in Yerushalayim. And I am curious, you have college age groups. Do you ever have groups of younger people? I mean, you started your story today, your personal story, when you were quite young. And the thing about the unlearning, if we don't have to unlearn and we can start with direct learning, there's something very powerful that's possible. So have you ever considered working with younger people?
In a business aspect, we work with anybody who will pay or if somebody will subsidize them. But yes, we do some bar mitzvah group and we're working with...
I have a medical...
You're doing a bar mitzvah?
I'm doing it, yeah.
And those people came through word of mouth. Their family members came on a trip with us and they're coming and they kept telling them, you have to come with Mejdi, you have to come with Mejdi. And eventually they're like, okay, whatever, can we talk to them? And so this is kind of awesome. How many Palestinian CEOs of companies setting up a bar mitzvah trip for a Jewish family? We're doing family trips for synagogues and we're pushing hard to get more synagogues coming. Quite a few, I think, feel a little awkward about working again with a Palestinian co-owned company. But a few, one after another, are coming through and we're getting more and more of these. We have a few synagogues coming in this year. We just had one last week. Did you meet with the return of the land of... the trip name was Return to the Land of Our Soul. It was a fascinating name. I don't know if you met with them, but yeah, we're bringing more groups. But with tourism, it depends on the customers, and I think a lot of people are afraid to send just youth alone here. However, the Bereaved Families Forum still mainly focuses on youth. They do over 1,000 meetings every year in high schools, talking to kids on both sides and telling them their stories, and I think that is very important. I think one of the things that needs to change here is our education systems on both the Palestinian and Israeli side, because we know nothing about each other, and we have no exposure whatsoever. I mean, even if you're in an Arab school in Nazareth, you don't know Jewish students. You know what? I'll take it even beyond. If you're an ultra-Orthodox student in Mea Shearim, you don't know any secular student just 50 meters away. And I think that segregation in schools is problematic. Betty Williams, who's a Nobel Peace Laureate, told me about her experience building one of the first schools and bringing Catholic and Protestant kids together. And she said they came together, and it was very hard to get them beyond that. You're Catholic, you're Protestant, you're Catholic, you're Protestant. So she brought a Buddhist monk, and she said, now they will understand the world is beyond Catholic and Protestant. And the Buddhist monk talked to them, was amazing. He leaves, and she asked him, what do you think? And they were like, wonderful, we like him, he's cool. But is he Catholic or Protestant? And unless we push so much more of that interaction, we set in our way. The world is us versus them. That's often how people see it. That's how we grow up seeing it. That's how I grew up, and that's how many of my friends on the Israeli side grew up. And we have to change the narrative. I'll give you a couple examples. I grew up hearing that the Crusade Wars were always about killing Muslims. That's inaccurate, even though it was in my textbooks. It's a complete BS. Why? Because Crusades first were not all against Muslims. They also killed Jews, but not only that. The Fourth Crusade was Christians fighting Christians. There were Crusades where Christians fighting pagans. It had nothing to do just with Islam. And then I learned that the word Crusades in Arabic, which is Salibiyin, was only in existence for less than 200 years. We didn't use those words. We used to say, well, the French and the Brit, you know, whichever group of the Crusades coming, we used to call them by which name. And it's only later became part of a larger narrative of Christians and Muslims always hated each other. And the same happens with Jews. When you hear now about the Holocaust, you hear about one narrative, which is the Muslims supported the Holocaust and the Mufti did it. He's behind so much of it. But you will not hear so many other stories. Stories like the Imam in Paris who forged letters to the Jewish community. They're saying they were Muslim so he could save them. Or the Iranian consul in France that gave passports to Jews so they can, Iranian passports, so they can escape. And then went and argued with the Nazis that Jews were Aryans and they should not be killed. And was able to save, it's believed, up to 2,000 people through that method. Or a place like Albania, where a majority Muslim country was able to save thousands of Jews. We don't hear about these stories because they don't fit in the narrative of us versus them. And my hope is that through travel, we can change that. I'll tell you just quickly maybe about another project I'm doing now. It's very new. Look it up. It's called I Am Your Protector. And what we're doing is exactly that. It's looking for people who have protected somebody from another side, whether it's gender, religion, whatever it is, but somebody who's different, and we're using these personal stories, and we're doing campaigns, and doing news releases, and doing on these personal stories, whether it's as far back as the Holocaust, the Muslims I just mentioned, or as recent as a Syrian refugee jumps in the water in a canal in Amsterdam to save a guy who fell in, and while everybody else was taking pictures and videos, it was a Syrian refugee who jumped in and saved him and was getting and received this award from the mayor calling him the perfect citizen of Amsterdam. These are the stories we should be telling because they change stereotypes. And if we only go with whatever is the mainstream and whatever we learn in our textbooks, which sets a very specific narrative of us versus them, and we always hated each other, it's always been terrible, we just cannot get along, one group is always backward idiots and one group is smarter, and normally we are smarter and they are all idiots, we cannot move forward with that. We have to start changing the story. I see it on Facebook a lot. Whenever there's a conflict, everyone goes back to their own position And suddenly we become, even if you leftists, rightists, peace activists, suddenly everyone starts posting these things. Well, an attack happened and they want to kill us and so on. And we don't think about what is that doing to the people who are reading these posts, even on a small level. Because if I, as a peace activist, falling into that, then people who are listening to me are saying, see, there is no way forward. Instead of looking for different kind of narrative, different kind of story. Yes?
You mentioned that, so I think this will have to be our last question.
Can I do a quick kind of overview and I can do a 5 minutes of closure?
Okay.
All right. I'll take a 3-4 quickly. And
very, very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that you didn't learn the Holocaust growing up. How did you hear about it to learn to go to Yad Vashem?
Okay. That's easy. From people like Rami Elchanan, who told me about it and I had no idea what they were talking about. Okay.
I find everything you're saying really compelling. Personally, I really am on board with it. I'm wondering how, in these particular situations, what's driving people's us versus them mentality is like more or less fear of death.
Okay, I'll come to that. Somebody who didn't ask there.
It seems like the work you're doing with building bridges and connecting people is really
right.
Important. You were mentioning about breaking down walls. So I'm curious, just big picture, does it Tuesday solution seem like a bad idea?
Okay, and here? And then I'll answer.
I'm curious, in a lot of this is developing narratives around regular people's lives, sort of taking off the mask of a narrative being over and above someone's actual life and sharing their suffering and sharing their perspective. But when it comes to actual institutions, and I think the best example is the one that you think you started with, which is like the Israeli army, for instance. There are people in this country that are very left, center-left, whatever, and their ability to hear someone else's suffering stops when someone says to them, well, the army did this to me, right? Like family, so on. And on the other side, and I think your own story is probably the best example of this, when from the youngest age, your only exposure to the army, and you assume the army is there to hurt you and so on, how do you take an institution that is itself actually a truthful representation of itself, right? It isn't a cartoon, right? There is an army, and it carries weapons, and it does things that people support and don't support. How do you start to talk about institutions that actually carry the political and military muscle? It also happens on the side, but want to oppose the Israeli army with Hamas, and that creates a whole other, especially in the States, there's a lot of stuff. So I'm curious how you talk about something that actually is what it is.
That's a tough question. Okay, I'll start with how do you change the narrative, and I think you change it by changing the story. I think that's why this campaign I'm working on is telling people a different story, because that's what makes us afraid of each other. I was afraid of Israelis because every image I had of Israelis was negative. And as that image starts changing, it changes my perceptions, changes who I am, it changes who they are, and they're my friends. And I have guides go to the West Bank all the time, even though they're Israeli, and they're not afraid. I have a guide today in Nablus. I have another guide in Bethlehem. Why aren't they afraid? Because it's not because it's not scary. There are legitimate reasons, but they're not afraid because they have that relationship, and they have somebody Palestinian with them who knows, who they trust and know that would not let anything bad happen to them. And I think that's how we change it, is people only hear why they should be afraid. They never hear why not. The Bible says in the book of Proverbs that without vision, people perish. And I think that's the other thing. I listen to politicians all the time and I don't hear vision. If anything, it's normally negative vision. I don't want to turn it into politics, but I was listening to Bibi Netanyahu talk about when he said, people ask me, will we live by the sword? And his response was, yes, we will live always by the sword. And if that's the vision people are going to have, they will be terrified. Now, it's ironic because he should have read the book of Isaiah, which says the opposite, that you will turn your sword into a plowshare and, you know, not going to eventually kill each other. So we have to change that vision, give people hope and reason. As for your questions, I don't normally like to answer 2 states, 1 state, 3 states, because it makes people box me very quickly into what am I. And if I say I'm 1-stater, people think, oh, you're anti-Israel and you want to destroy the Jewish state. And if I say I'm 2-state solution, like, what do you mean exactly? And you don't want people to live together and it's not doable anymore. And so I try to do less of that because I'm not at the moment in a place where my opinion will really make much influence. I say I'm open to all these views. I favor something in the middle. I favor a confederacy, federal system. But I'm open to whichever solution if it's really doable. How do you change systems? How do you change policy? I think you have to look at it a little bigger. The army does whatever they are told to do by the political structure. Actually, interestingly, lately in Israel, it's the people in the army who are coming across more. Now they are attacked for being leftists, right? It's generals who are suddenly traitors because they're saying things that... But they understand it because they're working with the Palestinian police and they're coordinating together and they're all saying, no, it's working very well between us. Then the politicians telling them, shh, that's going to make people like each other. Stop telling them that. That is changing the narrative. So I think we have to make more pressure on politicians. And politicians respond to two things, money and votes. And that's maybe a one way we can end this conversation. In the study of revolutions, you need 2% of population to get out, to be active, to potentially make a change in government. 2%, not a huge number. The problem with that is only 5% of those who believe in your message are normally active people. So you have to convince either more of those who believe to become active. You know, when people tell you don't speak to the converted because they already believe, that's not true. Most people who believe in whatever message you are telling them will not act upon it. You have to either shift that or you have to get more people to believe in your message so you can have 2% to be heavily active. At the moment, even though majority of people, you know, I get asked a lot, majority of people believe in peace. Why it's not happening? Because we're not able to get to those 2% or to those 5%. To be more active. And I think that's what we need to do, start realizing it is at the end about numbers. How many people believe and how many people willing to do something about it. Indifference is the biggest problem that we are facing. Amos Oz said, if you're passing by a building on fire, you have three options of what you do. The first one is you run away because you don't want to get involved. That's what a lot of people do, even if they want to help. The second one, you create a committee to decide who to blame for this, which is also what a lot of people to do. Well, but the Palestinians did this and this and this, and you do this, and they just knifed somebody. Well, but the Israeli army, like you were saying, did this and this and this, and how do you want me to even talk to them? And the third one is to get a bucket, fill it with water, and throw it on the fire. And if you don't get a bucket, you get, you can actually go to the next picture. You get a cup, you fill it with water and throw it in the fire. And if you don't get a cup, you get a spoon, you fill it with water and throw it in the fire. Because even though one person with a spoon cannot put out a fire, enough people with the spoons, buckets, and cups would. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.